So we'll go ahead and get started. It's 3 o'clock, and thank you all for coming. So this is the Controlling the Spread of Antimicrobial Resistance in Neisseria gonorrhoeae in Latin America and the Caribbean, the Gonococcal Antimicrobial Susceptibility Program, GASP session. And we've heard a lot about antimicrobial resistance in Neisseria gonorrhoeae, and including from different areas of the world. And I think this session will be a wonderful spotlight on what's going on in Latin America and the Caribbean, both the data and also the program. And I'm Bob Kirkcaldy from the CDC, and my co-moderator is Dr. Joanne Dillon, who's one of the luminaries in the field, and is one of the founding director of the LAC GASP. So I'm going to turn it over to her, and she's going to have any opening words or provide an excellent talk on the challenges and opportunities.
Thanks Bob. Hello, everyone. I guess my opening words are largely going to be my talk. Today I want to talk about challenges and opportunities in the GASP. I think this morning we heard about some regional GASPs where we're all struggling with similar problems, financial, capacity building, and so forth. And one of the oldest GASP networks actually is in Latin America and the Caribbean. It's equivalent to GASP Asia. And most of the GASPs that were developed subsequently, including in resource-rich countries, came after these initial efforts. So I'm going to talk to you a little bit about the past, the present, and the future today. So the treatment of gonococcal infections is based on therapeutic guidelines that are usually established nationally. Most countries do have national guidelines, and they're typically based on aggregated current national trends in antimicrobial susceptibility. And there's some discussion about whether we should have regional guidelines and basically whether data should be aggregated like that. The gonococcus develops and maintains decreased susceptibility and resistance to almost every class of antibiotic that's been recommended. And because of that, I mean, it's an ancient problem, basically. It started with sulfonamides and has gone forward with each class of antibiotics subsequently. But in 1990, at the World Health Organization, there was a meeting, and they called for a global surveillance network for gonococcal antimicrobial susceptibility. And at that time, the GASP LAC region was established. And in fact, the United States and Canada were part of the network. But basically, both of those countries have gone on to establish sustained GASP or GISP networks on their own. So this is the issue that's of such importance to the World Health Organization. Ever since the 30s, the systematic development of resistance to each class of antibiotics. So this figure shows the date of introduction of an antibiotic, and also at the end of the line, basically the date in which resistance first appeared. And the numbers within the lines show how long it took for resistance to develop after the introduction of those antibiotics. So for some antibiotics, they've had a fairly long shelf life, 30 years, but others have had, since they were recommended for treatment, a much shorter shelf life. And that's a real problem for all of us. And the impetus for basically re-engaging GASP networks recently has been the reports worldwide now of decreased susceptibility or probable resistance or de facto resistance coupled with documented treatment failures to third generation cephalosporins. And this usually includes many documented treatment failures to cefixime, some to ceftriaxone, and these isolates / strains, as we've heard, tend to be resistant to multiple antibiotics as well, limiting the choice of future treatment options and forcing us to consider other treatments such as dual treatment. So the recent Global Action Plan basically was a response to the development of resistance of third-generation cephalosporins. Interestingly, the WHO for this action plan specified the role of GASP networks in preventing the emergence of drug-resistant Neisseria gonorrhea. And I'm happy to say, since the GASP LAC was initiated in 1990, to varying degrees of success and competency, we've addressed many of these things. Of course, there's a lot of work to do. Surveillance, capacity building has been huge, and especially with the introduction of syndromic management of cases, we've had to reestablish basically capacity in many countries. Communications and education strategy for the general public and key populations. I have to say, maybe we haven't been as good as that with respect to GASP, but WHO has done a great job for us. Advocacy and political engagement. Early warning system. So basically there's an early warning system now for monitoring decreased susceptibility or resistance to third generation cephalosporins. Resource mobilization, which is a huge issue for us, and research. So the GASP network is quite all-encompassing. Right now, these are the countries that are actively engaged in the GASP, and that includes Cuba. But many countries were engaged in the 1990s, especially the CARICOM countries in the Caribbean, 23 of them, and are no longer engaged. But as I mentioned, Cuba has been actively engaged since inception. And our goal is basically to engage every country in Latin America and the Caribbean in the GASP network so that they can make informed decisions about treatment guidelines in their countries. So several countries have national surveillance programs involving multiple regions, and some of those have expanded as a result of the GASP LAC activities. Some countries collect a limited number of isolates from a single center on an annual basis. Some countries can only report sporadically. And a number of countries have lost capacity, and we're presently trying to rebuild that capacity. The interesting thing about the GASP LAC is that there has been consensus on methodology all the way from Canada to the tip of Argentina. And we're all using CLSI interpretive criteria. We're all using established WHO control strains as well as the CLSI control strains. There's been more or less a consensus reached on the types of diagnostic criteria for Neisseria gonorrhea, especially for the culture of it. And our website there for the GASP LAC is indicated, and we have laboratory manuals, training guidelines, also past data, and that appears in Spanish and English. And our training programs are ongoing. So let's talk about some of the recent trends. Now, I want to mention that we've gone from basically aggregating data over decades to biannual reports, and we're just collecting reports from 2012 and 2013. So the data here for 2012 and 2013 is not complete for the region, but it does indicate what's happening. Now, most countries actually cannot test for third-generation cephalosporins because some of the antibiotics are not available, and they're not available for treatment either. However, we've been able to observe reports from various countries on isolates, especially for ceftriaxone, which would be defined as probable resistance using WHO criteria. The interesting thing about this is that there was a peak in 2011, and it subsequently declined, even with our limited number of isolates, mirroring what happens in the rest of the world. I want to thank Patricia Garlarza for these wonderful data from Argentina. And basically, the Argentinian data also mimics global data and the GASP data as a whole, in the sense that first of all, the distribution is becoming biphasic, that there's so-called MIC creep, slightly increasing MICs, but there has been a decline in the prevalence of probable resistance in the last couple of years. So it's very encouraging to see that basically we're mimicking trends in other countries. Dr. Garcia, Galarza has also done a lot of molecular work. She was one of the first to actually document high-level azithromycin resistance and many other trends in Latin America. And it's interesting that when she looked at some of the probable resistant isolates for ceftriaxone, that basically the NG mass type was, of some of the isolates, was one of the ones reported globally, 1407. And she's noticed two types of mosaic, type 10, which has been observed in Asia, Australia, and Canada, and the type 34, which is the one that has been associated with global distribution. If we turn our attention to ciprofloxacin, in the mid-1990s, there was an explosion of resistance to ciprofloxacin, and also some of the highest reported levels of azithromycin in the region. Here are some of our more recent data from 2010 onwards, and you can see that in most of the countries, almost all of them, that are reporting, that the percentage of isolates resistant to cipro is greater than 5%, indicating that that should not be used as a treatment option. If you look at azithromycin, not every country tests, but you can see the dark red trend line. And basically, azithromycin has been increasing over time, and there's considerable variability between countries on percentage of isolates that are resistant to azithromycin. And here's our more recent data, where some of that resistance appears to have dropped off. So it would be very interesting to look at mechanisms of resistance, because we know that with certain mechanisms, azithromycin resistance with the efflux pumps and ceftriaxone are basically combined in a similar mechanism. If we look at tetracycline susceptibility trends since 1990, Latin America and the Caribbean was distinctive because they had, in some cases, over 50% resistance. A lot of it was chromosomal, and that's been declining somewhat, but there's still very, very high percentage of tetracycline-resistant isolates, both chromosomally mediated and plasmid mediated. The same thing with penicillin. Overall, penicillin resistance remains high and is increasing. Chromosomal resistance to penicillin is especially increasing. And this is interesting because the PenA gene that specifies penicillin resistance is also implicated in resistance to third-generation cephalosporins. Interestingly enough, I think with the decrease in selective pressure, PPNG percentage resistance has declined substantively. So what are the challenges for the GASP LAC for 2014 and beyond? Well, first of all, the number of countries that are reporting and able to participate and actually have the capacity has declined since 1990. And a lot of the smaller countries that basically resource-limited countries that previously had laboratories no longer have laboratories, and this is reflected in the participation percentages. We have increased marginally the number of isolates tested overall across all countries, and I just want to say that for 2012 and 13, the report is incomplete, so I expect it basically to be equivalent to what we've seen in 2010, for example. But nevertheless, the representativeness of the data is of concern. The other thing that's a real limitation is the complicated method for MIC testing. this has not changed in 40 years, and I'm going to get on my bandwagon and say that, you know, we really need a simpler method. Well, somebody might say there is a simpler method. It's the e-test. But the e-test is very expensive. It has to be standardized, and there are all sorts of methodological issues with using the e-test. So this is still the gold standard, but basically what we need is something where countries can have an overview of what's happening with respect to susceptibility, and maybe that's a point-of-care test or a rapid test. Additional challenges. We want to move to annual and not biannual reporting, but that's a real challenge. Some countries can't do MIC testing or even e-test, so they use discs at a national level. We're always asked for antibiotics from different countries. Getting antibiotics is a serious problem and a real limitation to doing antimicrobial susceptibility testing. There's limited availability of media and reagents, so we really need partners in the GASP, and I think it's time for us to reach out and really have a multinational effort and partnership with respect to getting really sustainable and good data out of the region. Of course, there are always transportation issues in remote regions and equipment. The external and internal quality assurance programs have been sporadic, but we're going to have a talk about that in this session. We really need peer-reviewed publications of country-specific data, and we need the translation of laboratory information into public health policy. We've had limited success, but we have to do much better at this, and for this, we really need a kind of program science approach. So basically, we're going to have a wonderful talk coming up as well, reviewing the treatment guidelines and the issues with respect to current treatment guidelines in Latin America. So what would be some future solutions maybe to this issue of capacity building, getting information from the region, getting information in a timely fashion? So the gold standard, as recommended by the WHO for most regions, is still culture. NATs are not used in Latin America yet. It would be helpful, but of course you can't get antimicrobial susceptibility data out of NATs. But that's something that's being worked on. So basically the introduction of rapid tests for case finding and point of care tests might very well help the situation, and there are many groups that are working on this. Is there a place for a rapid or molecular test in some economies and a POCT in others? So we also have to establish new ways to detect antimicrobial resistance. Is it really just MIC testing? We need basically a more comprehensive molecular understanding of resistance mechanisms from Latin America and the Caribbean. So I would suggest that we need to have a network that detects pivotal genetic mechanisms or characteristic sequences with respect to antimicrobial resistance, and these tend to be multiple. Some gene sequences are characteristic of a particular type of antimicrobial resistance, for example, PPNG isolates, or certain SNPs for single nucleotide polymorphisms for antibiotics resistances such as ciprofloxacin. And by having a global snapshot or even a POCT that's validated, it might be useful to determine whether an isolate is susceptible to an antibiotic or not, and whether actually antibiotics that were formerly used can actually be used in a limited sense, providing that surveillance is ongoing. So I'll be very optimistic. If there is a POCT developed, it may alleviate some of the testing issues. And as Dr. Garcia said in her previous talk, actually to have a multiple POCT that would diagnose several pathogens in different formats, including DNA testing and antibody-based formats, would be ideal, and there are some technologies that can do that. and I think this would be a great help for Latin America. Now, is a POCT for gonococcal antimicrobial resistance possible immediately? No. I think we have to target antibiotics that we might want to prolong the life of. We have to have studies looking at the evaluation of certain resistance mechanisms as a predictive factor in a population-based analysis so that instead of looking at individual cases, we could combine, aggregate the data, and maybe get better information. I do know that it's easier to send DNA to labs than it is to ship isolates. So I think I would like to propose and have a lot more discussion with people in the audience about a new paradigm for actually getting antimicrobial susceptibility or resistance data from various countries. So in conclusion, the GASP network in Latin America and the Caribbean has been functioning since the 1990s on an annual basis with many countries engaged, with different levels of expertise, of course. Unique AMR trends have been noted from Latin America and the Caribbean, and these have been noted worldwide. The mid-2000s, there was a significant increase in the percentage of isolates resistant to ciprofloxacin, and that has real implications for treatment guidelines in the region, as many countries retain cipro, as we're going to hear. We need more extensive MIC testing for susceptibility to extended spectrum cephalosporins, maybe coupled with follow-up on treatment failures, if that's possible, linkage to other STIs, and minimal epi data. This requires a concerted multifocal effort. And we have to encourage all countries in the region to engage in the GASP program. So I'd like to thank our partners in the GASP LAC for all their work amid a variety of hardships and challenges. But it's really a wonderful network that has real promise. Thank you very much.